Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Apologies for the pre-pod interruption, but you need to know something. The conversation you're about to hear was taped, as it always is, on a Tuesday morning, about 10:15 L.A. time. It's now 12:30 L.A. time, and about 20 minutes ago, the President of the United States tweeted out that he is stopping all negotiations on an economic rescue plan. So now you know. And here we go. All right, I'm ready.
Well, hey, everybody long time ready? No
oh,
chat.
Oh, my goodness. Here it goes. Here it goes. I don't even know who's supposed to start. I don't even have anything in front of me yet. But Drew just said, we're
well,
going.
I'll just say, hi, Kai. I'm Kimberly Adams.
Oh,
and
goodness.
Welcome to Make Me Smart. Wow. It's Tuesday, which is the deep dive day. And it's the first time I've been able to do this with you in a while. Hi.
It has been a while. Hi, how are you? How you been?
I'm good, thank you. There's a lot going on here in D.C.
Oh, my lordy be. Oh, my goodness. But we're not going to talk about any of that. We're going to talk about some other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, look, so yes, let's obvious stuff. The president has COVID-19, as do a bunch of other people in his orbit. That much we know. Specifics keep trickling out. We've been talking about that's kind of everywhere. But yeah, it is kind of nice to take a little break from that.
And so we will. And the news framing of it is that phone conversations apparently continue between Speaker Pelosi and Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin about some kind of economic relief package for this economy. They are something like $700 billion or $1 trillion apart, depending on who you listen to. One of the sticking points is how much aid should go to state and local governments? So we've gotten an expert on the phone to make us smart about why that matters and how big a deal it is. Her name is Louise Shaner. She is an economist with Brookings in Washington, also at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. Louise, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So look, let me get a sense from you of how important, we talk about the federal government and the macroeconomy all the time. How important are state and local budget situations to the big picture?
They're very important. So the state and local sector is quite a large sector of the economy. I think the easiest way of looking at it is employment. And state and local workers comprise 13% of the total workforce. So they're pretty major. And if you think about the recovery from the Great Recession, you know, it was really very tepid spending on the part of the state and local governments. That was really one of the factors that made it so slow and such a weak recovery. So it's really important to think about that sector.
Well, if we're talking about recovery, I mean, we're still in the pandemic, but how are state and local budgets playing into the way the economic fallout of the pandemic is happening and the eventual recovery?
So state and local governments have cut back on employment, less than the private sector, but they have cut back on unemployment. And so that's one factor that's obviously keeping employment down. It's not clear how much of that is due to budget pressures versus how much of that is due to the fact that they've closed things, like they don't need bus drivers and they don't need cafeteria workers. So I think it's the budget situation is more looking forward about what happens and what kind of stresses they're going to face. So I think at the beginning of the pandemic, you were hearing numbers that like the state and local sector would need like $1 trillion based on looking at what the unemployment rate was and the relationship between unemployment and state revenues kind of in the last recession. I recently did a paper sort of saying, well, is that a good way of looking at it? Because this recession is just so incredibly different than the last one. You know, for the state and local sector, it's different really in important ways. So, like, one other thing that I think that's quite interesting is the unemployment is really concentrated on low-wage service workers, which is terrible for income inequality. But in terms of tax income tax revenues, it means it matters a bit less. The other thing that's kind of interesting is the, you know, very large expansion of the fiscal aid in terms of unemployment benefits, right? That extra $600 a week and having unemployment insurance be available to many more people than is usually the case. Not in all states, but in most states, unemployment insurance is actually taxable. So that helped as well. And the PPP money, the grants to the small businesses, also is going to end up largely taxable. So all those things helped a lot. And then finally, you know, unlike the 2009, the stock market so far at least has held up, which means that the capital gains losses that you had in terms of tax revenues last time around, not likely to happen again. On the other hand, the consumption patterns are so different this time, right? And so states that rely on fees and sales taxes with consumption falling so much because people are staying home, that has implications as well. So we sort of looked at all these pieces to see not sort of what is the normal response, but what's going to happen this time. So, you know, what we found was like the income tax losses are likely to be, you know, moderate, but not huge and much less than people thought. But some of these fees are really going to drive revenues down. So, for example, we calculated that the state and local governments are going to be losing $45 billion this year in fees related just to transportation. The fact that people are not traveling, right? That means airport fees, parking fees, tolls, gas tax, gas fees, all those things are really, really big. So it's just totally different than ever before.
Louise, let me ask you this, though.
And
this is going to sound like a real basic question, but I think probably a lot of people are wondering, if the federal government can borrow money till the cows come home to pay all its bills, why can't states just do the same? I mean, what's the big deal?
Good. Yeah, so state and local governments mostly have balanced budget requirements, right? So they are not allowed to borrow to finance their operations, right? So when revenues fall, they have to make it up somehow, either by raising taxes or much more likely by cutting spending. So that's the big worry, that the revenues are going to fall, they'll cut back on spending. And when they cut back on spending, that sort of makes the recession worse, right? Then they're not cutting back just because of the pandemic, but they're cutting back because they don't have any money. And so that's really what the big fear is and why people are calling for aid, because we do not want that to happen.
But one of these fights, one of the reasons that this fight is happening on the Hill over this aid is sort of this idea of Republicans are making the argument that they don't want to bail out states that had been fiscally irresponsible in the past. I mean, has the budget outlook for states kind of depended on where they were heading into the pandemic?
I mean, states were in really good shape heading into the pandemic. They'd all been really careful following the Great Recession and had built up these rainy day funds to sort of, you know, really unprecedented levels. Now, of course, some states have problems and, you know, that we know about. Illinois has been having a lot of budget problems. But the losses coming from the pandemic have nothing to do with that, right? This is just, you know, states that, you know, were counting on, you know, revenues from a sort of an economy that was doing fine to ones that have just really lost revenues. And it's not a bailout in any way, shape, or form. It's really saying, look, we've had this pandemic. The right thing to do when you have a crisis is to smooth through it. You shouldn't, like, cut back on services and cut back on spending. And that just makes it worse for everyone because of the macroeconomic impacts. So I think that's just not a reasonable argument, right? This is not about bailing out. This is just about saying, look, we don't want governments to be cutting back on spending during a recession. And so it's better for everyone if we smooth through it and borrow, and the federal government is the one who can borrow, and they can borrow cheaply, and they should help. So I think the question is sort of how much help do state and local governments need?
Well, you read my mind. How much help do state and local governments need?
So, you know, the hard thing about that question is what we know is we did some calculations in this paper on what we thought the revenue losses would be. So for this year, for 2020, calendar 2020, we thought the revenue losses were about $155 billion, or about 5.5% of their own source revenues, the revenues that they own collect from fees and taxes. And there's been quite a bit of aid passed already. So the total aid passed, excluding aid to public hospitals and higher education, which we think is separate, has been about $212 billion. So there's sort of few key missing from that story, though. One is the aid was passed, like the biggest piece was the $150 billion in the coronavirus relief fund, because states face higher spending demands now, right? They've got to be spending on public health, and they've got to be spending on contract tracing and testing. And so we just don't know how much all of that is costing. So they definitely have enough aid to cover their losses this year, but that aid was basically one time. They're looking at potentially multi-years of losses and revenues. And I think they're being very careful to say, we can't just spend all that aid right now, because then next year, we're just going to be pushing off the budget problem till next year. And so, you know, I don't know how much they need. I'm not going to give a number.
Yeah.
It's less than the $1 trillion that I think. I think it's less than the $1 trillion that people, well, I think people were quite afraid in the spring and thought it was really going to be that large. And also, you know, thought that the unemployment rate was going to stay higher for longer, right? I mean, I think the recovery that we've had so far has kind of surprised people at the speed of that. So I think it's less than that, but we do want to make sure that state and local governments, you know, have enough money, and really I think for two things. One, you don't want them impeding the recovery. And I, you know, one of the things that I think is really important is to remember that, you know, we had this amazing economy in terms of the unemployment rate before the pandemic hit, right? It was like 3.5%, and it was bringing people in from, you know, who had been marginalized and coming back into the labor force, and wages were starting to rise. And I think we can't get complacent and say, oh, you know, it's not so bad. The unemployment rate's 5% if it comes down to that. I think we need, as a public policy, to say, no, we need to go get back to, as soon as this pandemic is over, we need to roar right back to where we were, and we need to do everything that we can. That's number one. Number two, I think we really need to think about the needs that arise from the pandemic, right? So, you know, what kind of education are kids getting from this virtual schooling, and how much could money help either now, or if they can't figure out how to do it well virtually, then remedial education, right? Once the pandemic passes, that's really, really important. And so it's important that state and local governments have the funds to be able to really do the right thing for these kids.
All right. So if I'm a municipal worker in Sacramento, or a public school teacher in Ottumwa, or any one of the millions of other state and local employees, and I look at these negotiations going on, such as they are in Washington, how worried ought I be?
Well, so much depends on the election. Right. Uh-huh. So it's October. It's October. You know, I'm not sure if there will be a deal between Pelosi and Mnuchin. And, you know, if there is a deal, there will be some aid, I'm sure. I'm not sure how much, but there will be some aid. I think, you know, if the Democrats win, then there'll clearly be a big aid package. And so a lot depends on that. And it would be better for them to get it now and to know that the money's coming, and so then they don't have to make any tough choices and can sort of make plans to spend the money appropriately and not cut back. I think, you know, as the better the election chances look for the Democrats, the less worried I would be if I were a state and local worker.
Thank you, Louise Shaner. She's an economist with the Brookings Institution and the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. That was super interesting. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been
fun. Thanks a lot, Louise. See you.
Bye-bye.
That was a lot to unpack, man.
It was a lot. I'm not sanguine that they're going to get stuff done in time, honestly, because if we wait for the election and then you have to wait for, like, the inauguration, and Biden would have to obviously win, and Republicans would have to lose the Senate before a huge package gets through. I don't think it's a done deal. That's all I'm saying.
Well, and if you are looking at that kind of timeline that you just laid out, and I agree with you, you know, that puts us well into the winter, where we could very well have more cases kind of on the way there. And, you know, it's still a health crisis that is also an economic crisis.
Yep. Amazing. So much of this is amazing. All right. We are going to take a break. Your comments on today's show, or any show that we do, or questions that you have, or actually to the point of our conversation today, what's going on in your state? What are you seeing in terms of layoffs and shutdowns and problems that are happening because your state may be having some revenue issues, which are a lot of states? Let us know. Email or voice memo. It's always better to hear you than us. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Coming right back.
Hi, beloved intern Ethan Parents here. On Thursday, October 15th, Make Me Smart celebrates its 300th episode. Now, don't tell Kai and Molly, but we want to surprise them with something special from you. We want to hear how we've made you smart in the past 300 episodes. So tell us something you've learned from Kai and Molly. Record your answer as a voice memo on your smartphone and send it to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And as always, thank you for listening and supporting this show.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
My flu shot still hurts. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, bless your heart. I'm sorry. That was a Midwestern bless your heart, by the way, not the Southern bless your heart. I have to specify all the time.
I didn't know that you had two varieties in you. I thought you were a Midwestern girl.
I am, but if you say bless your heart and it's well, like a Southern right. person, they think you're saying something entirely different. I legitimately am sad that you were suffering from your flu shot, but I'm glad that you got one.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, yes, I did get a flu shot and it hurts. Okay, we're going to do a little news as we get past our regional discussion of dialects in this country. Mine is super quick, but it's another... I don't understand how they didn't see this was going to happen. So there is news this morning being reported by the Associated Press and CNN and some others, and in fact, based on a statement from the Pentagon, that the Vice Commandant of the United States Coast Guard was in the Pentagon last week with some close-up in-person meetings with members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Vice Commandant has tested positive, and so the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the chairman are isolating. And I just think... It's an economic issue. It's a public health issue. It's a social fabric issue. This coronavirus is now a national security issue. Can they, of course, do their jobs from wherever they are? Yes, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has a red phone and the president can get him and all of this jazz. But holy cow. That's it.
What a concept.
It's crazy.
Isolating yourself when you test positive for... coronavirus.
It's you know what? The more people that get it, the more people are going to get it. And so let's have less people get it, especially people who are running the country.
That would be ideal. I was in an airport. Gosh, it seems forever ago. Yeah. But I went to go see my mother in May. And was in an airport just as, you know, things were pretty bad. And I remember talking to someone who was wearing a mask and she was saying, oh, you know, this is really serious. I guess it just has to happen to you before, you know, people mm-hmm. take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And I said to her, well, I certainly hope not. Yeah. But increasingly throughout this process, it's like it doesn't matter unless it happens to you or somebody you care about. And it gets to this just empathy gap. Anyhow.
Yeah.
But related, my news fix is kind of related to yours. And it's a Reuters exclusive that private contractors who were hired by Moderna, one of the pharmaceutical companies mm-hmm. working on a vaccine, have not gotten enough or found enough or used enough volunteers that are Black and Latino to effectively see how their vaccine works in those communities, which I should note, in case we missed it thus far, is the community – these are the communities that are being hardest hit by COVID-19, that in Native American communities. And like on one hand, I get it. Is I can speak to the Black community. People are very skeptical of engaging in vaccine trials. I mean, look up the Tuskegee experiments if you're wondering.
History matters.
Why
people,
that
for sure.
might be. But on the other hand, this is a vaccine in development that matters to these communities so deeply. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, based on this reporting from Reuters, that they didn't even kind of do the basics to make sure that these groups were represented. But I'll be fascinated to see if the pharmaceutical – I mean, in the story, it says the pharmaceutical companies are working overtime to try to correct this. But, you know, it's another kind of blow against whether or not people are going to have the trust that they need to get us out of this.
Yeah. Rooted in history and a history of non-inclusiveness and all of that stuff. And that, you know, comes and bites you in the rear end.
It really does.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, mailbag.
Let's do the mailbag.
Let's go.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
I always love that slightly different but mostly related thing. There's an email from a listener who says he has a quibble with the phrase K-shaped recovery, which is something you guys have been talking about a lot on the show and elsewhere about just the different ways that people are recovering in this pandemic. And they this person has a suggestion. This is Jeff Nolan.
If you look at the letter K, there's a big vertical bar on the left that doesn't really represent anything in terms of recovery. Once you get rid of that bar, you're left with two diverging lines, one going up and another going down. Most of us recognize that from our elementary school days as a less than symbol. We don't have a K-shaped recovery. We have a less than recovery. And that is the perfect name for what is going on in this economy. Workers in industries like restaurants, theater, and travel are seeing less than they ever have before. The most marginalized people in our country are recovering less than the most well-off. And at the end of it all, many of us will be left with less than we started with.
Yeah,
I
think that's totally right. I think that's really good. That's totally really good.
I vote for adoption of that.
Yeah, for sure. Totally a good one. Okay, so last week, Wednesday, we had a question from Allie in Oregon on What Do You Want on a Wednesday? The question was, why is there not a word yet that means I was misled by the internet, preferably a verb? Molly, as you might remember, suggested Facebooked from her son. Here's a couple of you, though, that had different answers. Jordan Braun, I really think the verb for being misled by the internet should be zucked, which is related, because Zuckerberg. Slightly different, but the same. Eric Goldshine said zuckered. Sounds like suckered. For example, he says, I got zuckered into thinking a bunch of mail-in ballots were thrown into a river because of something my mom posted the other day. Had to get that one fact-checked. Oh, snap. That's a good one. It's a good one. Here's another one, actually, coming from, I know, right? Here's another one, Patty Shaw.
I think we should call it being twit-booked because, first of all, it covers more than just Facebook, but also people who believe anything they read on the internet look like twits. Bye.
That's not bad. What's really interesting is the opprobrium that Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg are coming in for here. I just think that's revelatory.
Yeah, although I would caution against using zucked as Jordan suggested, because you can very easily get into some trouble with the slip of the tongue there.
It could go bad in a hurry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Kai, I brought in a little tape myself this time, and I want to talk to you about it.
What? I don't even know what to say.
Do you recognize that? You don't.
Should
I? That means that you did not watch Never Ending Story.
I confessed yesterday.
You had watched Never Ending Story.
I inoculated myself against this very instance. And I said you were going to be listening, and clearly you weren't. No, I didn't watch it yet.
I thought maybe you would have gotten to it like last night or something.
Well, I thought about
it. Because you have nothing else to do.
Honestly, I went on a bike ride.
Clearly in your life.
I went on a bike ride. I know.
You all right, said can
we
you
would. We can stop the music now, please. Thank you very much.
No, that's a great song. Yeah. Don't knock the never-ending story song.
Let us not humiliate me any farther, shall we? Okay.
All right. Fine.
Point taken. Thank you very much. I knew it was coming. All right. Here we go. The Make Me Smart question is where we end. What is something you thought you knew, but you found out you were wrong about? I had Eva Price back on Marketplace yesterday. She did, she produced the revival of Oklahoma that won a Tony a year or so ago. She's got Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill on Broadway. Well, now, I mean, it was before they had to stop. Anyway, I asked her the question, what is something you thought you knew but found out you were wrong about? And here's what she said.
I thought I knew that my optimism was the way to get me and everyone around me through tough times. I thought it was an obvious and natural way to lead and to be. And the fact is, my optimism is often wrong, and it's not always the best. Best of intentions, best faith efforts, and the best way to do things is not how the rest of the world always behaves. And that's a sad thing that I knew, but that just means I have to open my eyes wider, be ready for it all, and sometimes be the tough guy.
Pretty good, right? I mean, it's really interesting because, and I've spoken to her a couple of times now, and she is relentlessly upbeat about the future, about her prospects, about the shows. And to have her say, oh, yeah, that doesn't always work, I think that was a pretty good one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one of our colleagues at APM, Christina, sent me something the other day about sort of toxic optimism, mm-hmm, I think is what mm-hmm, it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This idea that, yep, you know, kind of like, oh, stiff upper lip, we can get through this, all that. You know, it doesn't always
work
help.
That way. That's for sure. That's for sure true. You bet.
Yeah. All right. That's it. That's it for today's show. So don't forget to send your questions for tomorrow to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line the questions, and we'll see you next time.
Excellent. So it's Marielle on Wednesday. Are you coming back? Or I mean, I guess the root of my question is, do I have to duck that whole movie thing again with you? Or or what?
Just watch the movie, Kai. Don't worry about who's going to be where. Just watch the movie.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ben Hethcote does video. Ethan Peretz does everything. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Thank you so much for the music, and mixed by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, and the executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves.
Oh, man.
Who I imagine, because she's cool, has probably watched Neverending Story.
She probably has. Bridget just slacked me. She said, yeah, Kimberly's coming back Thursday, Friday. So I guess we'll talk about it.
You know,
some
not
more.
That there's anything else on your to-do list. I'm sure you'll find time for the important
yes.
things.
One always does.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.